everybody. Welcome to episode 462 of the Comics Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is the new Comics Wednesday episode for August 15th, 2018. And I've got a few titles I'm going to talk about, and then I'll give a rundown of some of the other books I think you might want to be on the lookout for in your comic shops this Wednesday. So let me start with the 12th issue of a title from Aftershock. It's Baby Teeth from writer Donnie Cates, with art by Gary Brown, also the co-creator of the title, and colors by Mark Engelert. So this finishes off the second volume of Baby Teeth. And for those not familiar, it's the story of a girl, a young girl, Sadie, who gives birth to supposedly the son of Satan, the Antichrist, supposed to usher in a whole new age. And there's different factions. It's a very political title. There's different factions fighting over the child. Whether or not the child's evil is up for debate. But there's not a lot of heavy religious overtones, which sounds kind of weird when you talk about a title that's about the Antichrist, basically. But that's what I was kind of worried about, that the religion was going to be very heavy-handed. It's not that at all. What Donnie Cates has done is build a world full of extremely compelling characters, and the uniqueness of the characters and their interactions with each other in the world that Cates has created is what makes this title so compelling. So for those who have been following along, the baby Clark was swept off into another realm called the Red Realm. And he's there with Sadie's sister, Heather, and for a long time, Sadie and her father have been trying to find a way to reach the Red Realm to try to rescue them, because it's a very terrifying and horrible place. They've met up with a couple of allies, and they've kind of been biding their time. So the book actually starts with Clark's first birthday. He is not there, and again, it's the interaction of the other characters, Sadie, her father, and their allies, that makes the book so compelling. And, you know, for a book about the Antichrist, it can be lighthearted at times, too. Cates does find a way to inject humor here and there, but it's also very poignant. At its heart, it is about a mother and her son, her love for him, and that's a very powerful thing, right? Like, mothers love their children, kind of irrespective of what they do. Like, it, you know, you hear about people who commit these horrible atrocities and yet their mothers still love them. You can love the person and hate what the person does, right? Like, hate their actions, but you never stop loving the person if you're a mother. And I firmly believe that to be true for the most part. You know, there are probably exceptions, of course, as there are to everything, but this has definitely been the culmination of what the story has been leading to in the second arc. And it ends on somewhat of a cliffhanger. Like, when I was reading it and I read the last line, I was just like, oh man, that's not good. So, again, I think it's a title that maybe not a lot of people are paying attention to, you know, as hot of a writer as Donnie Cates is. I think everybody's paying attention to what he does to some extent, but this is a title that I heard a lot about when it first came out, that a lot of people were reading. I haven't heard much about it lately, so I wanted to talk about issue 12 because the title's been quality throughout. You know, it's one of those Aftershock books, so you know, their titles pretty much without fail are all very strong, very high quality, well done, compelling stories, and great art. The art by Gary Brown really suits the type of story that Cates and Brown are trying to tell. Like, I was just thinking about it before, because I went back and I reread, I think, like issue 9 up through 12, because I was like, did I miss an issue? It turned out that I hadn't, but it was good to kind of go back and get some context and remember what was going on in the story. And I found myself thinking, how would this story feel different if it was a different kind of art, right? Because Gary Brown's art isn't the typical style of art that I enjoy. You know, it's not really clean lines. It's not traditional comic art. It's a little more of a sketchy style, kind of light on the backgrounds. But I found myself thinking that I don't believe that the typical kind of comic art that I'm normally drawn to would necessarily benefit the type of story that Cates and Brown are trying to tell. I think it would be doing the story a disservice. I think the style of art that Brown is using is perfectly suited for the story, and it makes things a lot more impactful. Also, the color work by Englert is exceptional. A lot of reds, as you might imagine. You know, I mentioned the Red Realm, you know, Son of Satan, things like that. But he also uses color at various times to really give us a lot of impact with panels that maybe are only two or three colors. You know, maybe it's nearly monochromatic or dichromatic, and it really helps us feel the emotion and the impact that the characters are feeling. So Baby Teeth 12, a welcome addition to the storyline. I can't wait to see where it goes from here. For those that are reading it in trade, man, I don't see how you read volume 2 and, you know, finish it and then don't immediately want to go out and pick up issue 13 because you got to know what happens next, right? And that's completely how I feel about it. So yeah, definitely recommend Baby Teeth from Cates, Brown, and Englert. The next title I'm going to talk about is also from Aftershock, from one of my favorite writers. You know, he's been on the show lots of times. It's Lost City Explorers by Zach Kaplan, with art by Alvaro Saraceca and colors by D. Cuniff, with letters by Troy Pateri. So when we last left our band of teenagers, they were fleeing from the mercenaries that were working for the Sagan Labs Corporation that Hell and Omar's father had worked for, and they had fled into the tunnels. And you kind of got the feeling that this is where their adventure was going to begin. Obviously, I don't want to give away too many spoilers, but despite the efforts of some trying to kind of appeal to Hell's, won't say better nature, but logical side, trying to get her to be practical and realize they're just kids and they can't really take on this quote-unquote evil corporation. Despite all that, Hell, there's no turning back for her. And she kind of leads the team, if you will, into deeper into danger, no pun intended, as they go deeper into the city. So again, this title, Zach has gone on record as saying it's very much kind of inspired by Goonies, that kind of adventure, young people on a quest kind of feel. He has nailed it completely. It's exactly the tone and the feel that the story has. You can tell that they're in over their heads. You can tell that they know they're in over their heads, but they're compelled, you know, by the personality of Hell. She's a natural leader, and I don't want to say she manipulates them, but she is leading them further into danger, and she knows that it's a dangerous situation. She knows she's somewhat in over her head, but she also is bound and determined to find her missing father. That kind of overrides any sort of sense of personal survival or a risk aversion that she might have. And so I find it to be very realistic. I think Zach writes these teenagers very well. Their interactions are realistic and fun. And I'm really enjoying the series. That being said, much like Baby Teeth, I couldn't really imagine another artist on this title. I think Alvaro Saraceca is doing a great job. You know, Zach has said a few times on the podcast how lucky he feels, really, with all the titles that he's been on so far, to have such great artists. And Saraceca may be the best of them all. The way he lays things out in the panels, his character acting in the faces, it's absolutely incredible. A lot of detail in the backgrounds, really good sharp lines, great emotionality. So I can't find a single thing about this book that I don't like. That includes the colors by D. Cuniff. A lot of blues and grays, as you might expect. from a book that takes place deep under New York City as they search for Atlantis. And this one ends on a cliffhanger as well. And I really can't wait to see where the story goes from here. This is really, really strong work from Zach Kaplan. And I've heard nothing but good things, nothing but positive buzz about Lost City Explorers. And this might be the title that, that finally puts Zach on the map mainstream. You know, he's got his other titles, Eclipse and Port of Earth over at Top Cow. And those are exceptional titles as well. But for some reason, I don't know that it's his name has gotten out there on the wider scale. But it wouldn't surprise me to find out that Lost City Explorers is the one that really starts resonating with your average comic reader and propels Zach into well-deserved higher profile projects. All right, next up, I'm going to talk about Pearl Number One. This is a new creator-owned title. It's the first one from Brian Michael Bendis's Jinx World imprint over at DC, and it's with his collaborator, longtime collaborator, Michael Gatos. That's the creative team that created Jessica Jones, for those of you who aren't aware, in the pages of Alias for Marvel's Max imprint back in the day. So this is the story of a tattoo artist who, it's unclear to me if she already was an assassin or if she kind of becomes an assassin through the events of this first story. It was a little hard for me to follow at times. And the art by Michael Gatos, it's very much Michael Gatos art. You know, it's almost photorealistic. But what I found strange was his use of color. Like a lot of, like almost every page is like we're looking through a filter. Some pages were looking through a green filter. Some pages were looking through a like a reddish rust colored filter. Others, it's like we're looking through a blue filter. I'm not sure if he's kind of putting these filters over the pages to set mood or tone. It's unclear to me. So I'm just not really sure. It ended up being a little confusing for me. I do think I'll pick up at least one more issue. You know, if any of you listen to my Superman Sunday episodes, you'll know that I'm not a, you know, huge Brian Michael Bendis fan. I kind of take his stuff on a case by case basis, and I'm leaning toward not reading this just because it just doesn't, it didn't interest me. I didn't find the characters to be compelling or interesting. There's nothing wrong with it per se. It's just, I don't really understand what's going on. I mean, I understand what's going on the surface, but I want more. Like, I want better understanding. And maybe it's on my end. Maybe I'm just not picking up what Bendis is putting down. I'm not sure on this one. I would say if you're a fan of Bendis, certainly give it a try. You'll probably like it. If you're not a Bendis fan, then don't bother. If you're somewhat in the middle like me, I don't know, maybe flip through it at the shop and see if it grabs your attention. Also, I'm not really into tattoos at all. And Pearl is a tattoo artist. And tattoos seem like they're going to play a big role in the title. So maybe that's another part of the reason that it didn't really interest me very much at all. So, you know, as longtime listeners of the show will know, I really don't usually talk about books that I don't find that I enjoy. But being that this was the first Jinx World title, a first issue, I felt like I probably should take a look at it. And yeah, it was just okay. Maybe slightly below average for me, but again, that might be my fault. The other thing I will mention is it does have a reprint of Bendis's very first DC work, which was Citizen Wayne, back in the day, a Batman story, Batman Elseworlds story that he did along with Michael Gatos for the Batman Black and White title, which I already own that, so it wasn't a, you know, a big deal. It's not it's not a bad thing. I mean, you're getting another story for free, basically. So, but yeah, if you're a Bendis fan, then I would recommend checking it out. If not, yeah, maybe pick it up, flip through it, see if it looks like something you might be interested in. All right, the next title that I'm going to talk about is Wildstorm number 16. This is from Warren Ellis with art by John Davis Hunt and colors by Brian Buccioletto. So this is issue 16 of 24. So we got about, 7 issues to go for Warren Ellis's Wildstorm series. I really hope we get more than that because I'm loving the way that Ellis is reimagining the Wildstorm universe. I know some longtime Wildstorm fans haven't necessarily been pleased with this kind of update, reimagined kind of world that Ellis is creating, but I find it to be fascinating because the characters aren't like super over the top 90s tropes, right? Or stereotypes like kind of the original Wildstorm universe. A lot of those characters were very much of their time, and seeing them reimagined as more of a conspiracy, evil corporation kind of slant, I find to be really enjoyable, especially characters like Backlash. So, and also seeing John Davis Hunt's art is never a bad thing. I think he, like, I can't believe more people don't know his name. He's probably in the top 3 artists working right now. His art is just absolutely spectacular, and I guarantee that if he's drawing a book, I will be picking it up regardless. I don't care who's writing it. I don't care what the story is. I will pick up a book that he draws simply because he is drawing it. His art is that spectacular. So seeing his take on these characters like John Lynch and Mark Slayton and even, oh my God, I'm totally drawing a blank. The girl from Gen 13. Oh, I can't believe I'm drawing a blank on her. But seeing his take on Fairchild, that's it, Fairchild. Yeah, seeing his take on these characters has been amazing. And just watching Io and Skywatch kind of fight for control of the Earth, unbeknownst to the average civilian kind of working behind the scenes. It's just a really cool plot aspect, and I love how it really dives into those conspiracy theories of, secret organizations ruling the world behind the scenes. And again, the reimagining of these characters, Angela Spica and Imp, it's great. Zealot, Voodoo, I mean, they're all there, right? They're all there, and I'm just loving the take. And I think this is going to be one of those stories that, you know, it'll be collected in a big omnibus or an absolute edition. Like, an absolute edition would be amazing because then you get to see that John Davis Hunt art up close. Like, I mean, take my money now. I'm buying the absolute edition of this when it comes out 100% without question. So if you're not reading Wildstorm, I have no idea what the numbers are. I haven't been paying attention. You can pick this up and check it out. And I almost think if you aren't intimately familiar with the Wildstorm universe, you'll enjoy it even more because, like I said, there have been a few Wildstorm fans that I've seen online kind of complaining it's not faithful enough to the original and why is everything getting changed around. But, I mean, Grifter still looks the same. He's still a badass. Like, Voodoo's still Voodoo. Zealot still Zealot. I mean, I don't know. I'm really enjoying it, and I think it's a really cool title, so I definitely recommend it. All right, the next title I'm going to talk about is Analog number 5. This is from writer Jerry Dugan with art by David O'Sullivan and colors by Michael Spencer. This is this issue 5 is the final issue of the first arc. And the premise of this story is that in the future, something really terrible happened, and all privacy on the internet pretty much went away. Like, there really is privacy on the internet anyway, you know? I mean, there's semblance of privacy, I guess. But really, if any of us have our identity stolen or our information stolen or leaked or whatever, it almost doesn't come as a surprise anymore, right? It's not even about when it's going to happen. It's just a matter of, or if it's going to happen, it's a matter of when it's going to happen. So at some point in the near future, all security on the internet's gone. So that brings to rise a profession of men called ledger men, who basically carry paper around. Like if you want something to be secure and no one to be able to see it, you put it on paper, right? Like it's not online, it can't be hacked. And so there's these ledger men, and they're basically couriers, and they take these papers different places that need to be secure. And so this is telling the story of one of those ledger men, Jack McGinnis. And this is very much a hard-boiled, noirish, I won't say crime because it's a little bit post-apocalyptic, but Jack McGinnis is definitely, you know, hard-nosed, take no prisoners, you know, hard-drinking kind of man's man, you know, the kind of guy that's going to bite down on a like a leather belt while he has bullets like dug out of him. I think if you like movies like Payback with Mel Gibson, then this will be right up your alley. So it's a compelling story or compelling idea, central idea that Dugan starts with, you know, this idea that there's no privacy anymore and things need to be curried from place to place, you know, sensitive information, things like that. And then you inhabit it with interesting characters like Jack McGinnis, his girlfriend Una, and the cities that he goes to, the places like Tokyo or San Francisco are still recognizable, but they're a little twisted, right? Dugan has said, okay, if the world changed this way, then how would this particular place with whatever makes it unique, how would it adapt? You know, so we see, you know, Tokyo much different. We see Tokyo without people, you know, staring down at screens all the time. Whereas San Francisco, we see immigrants because of, you know, ICE and immigration and all that, having a tougher time without the connectivity and the technology and everything. We see that give rise to a lot of speakeasies. So these immigrants have a place to go and socialize. And so little details like that that really make the world feel rich and inhabited. And as the end of the of issue 5 says, everything changes from here. The first arc has really kind of established what the world is like and who Jack is as a character, but nothing's going to be the same after the events of issue 5. We get introduced to kind of an arch nemesis for Jack, somebody that he has a history with. We get some really cool action with him kind of getting himself into a situation where he's a little bit in over his head. And the action really ramps up in this issue. And I imagine going forward that that's going to continue. Again, I feel like the first arc was Dugan kind of establishing who Jack is to the reader and what he's capable of, what his skills are. And now he's kind of throwing him into the fire, so to speak. And the other thing that I love about this book is on the back cover of each issue, there's in quotes a line from the issue. And I imagine it's what Dugan's favorite lines are, because the great thing about this title is there's always a line in there that at least one, oftentimes more than one, that'll make you chuckle. And they're great. They're really, really funny. So I love the fact that Dugan kind of calls attention to them, because if there's anything that I love about this title, other than kind of the overall premise, it's the dialogue. It's the dialogue between the characters. It's scripted very well by Dugan. He's somebody who I feel like doesn't get the credit he deserves. He's written some great stories. Probably wrote one of my favorite Hulk stories of all time a few years ago with the Omega storyline. So when this was coming out, when it was first being solicited, I read the premise. I'm like, oh, that sounds really cool. Oh, Jerry Dugan's writing it. Yeah, I'm in for sure. And the other thing that's great about the title is the feel and the tone of the world that Dugan's created is perfectly rendered by David O'Sullivan, the artist, and Michael Spicer, the colorist. Spicer really helps set the mood and gives it kind of that dirty, grungy feel, with his color choices and the palette that he's using. And O'Sullivan, his art reminds me quite a bit of Sean Martinborough in the Thief of Thieves title. It's a little, I don't want to say blocky, but it's a little squarish. You know, Jack McGinnis definitely has the square jaw, and it's not, you know, it's not like super fluid art, which I think would be a disservice to this type of story, because by tending to use lines and shapes that are a little more square, it makes the story feel very solid, if you know what I mean. It's like Jack comes across as a very solid character, a very strong character, because of the way that he's rendered, and that goes for the world as well. It's a hard world, you know. It's not delicate anymore. It's a little dirty, it's a little worn out, but there's a strength to it, and I think that the way that Sullivan's art comes across the page is very indicative of that. Plus, he's great at. I mean, he's just the perfect choice to draw Jack McGinnis, and he excels at facial expressions too. There are times when I feel like the dialogue isn't even necessary. All you need to do to understand what's going on in the panel is just look at Jack McGinnis's face. It's great. So it's the perfect time to jump on Analog as the first volume winds down and get ready to gear up for volume 2. And it does say at the end of issue 5 that Analog will return. Doesn't have a date though, but I don't imagine it'll be too long before this title comes back. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about is a number one, also from Image. It's Crowded number one from the creative team of writer Christopher Sabella. We've got Roe Stein on pencils, Ted Brandt on inks, and colors by Triona Farrell. 32 pages, and man, did this feel like a lot of story. And much like Analog, it starts off with a really interesting premise. So, you know, we've all heard of those people who have like, you know, 20 jobs. They like drive Lyft, they drive Uber, they use some other kind of app to pick up packages and drop them off, or other apps where they just get odd jobs like walking a dog or what have you. And so the main character here is one of those types of people, right? Like she drives for several ride sharing services. She rents out her car. She rents out her clothes. She walks dogs. She babysits. She tutors. Because the world, as opposed to Analog, the world of Crowded is all about social media, all about crowdsourcing, all about GoFundMes and Kickstarters and things like that. Well, one of the apps that's risen to prominence is called Reaper, and it's basically crowd-funded assassination. So if you don't like somebody, you can put their name on Reaper, and other people that don't like that person or want to donate to the campaign for whatever reason, they can donate to the amount that is eventually paid out if somebody proves that they killed this person. I don't know how it's illegal. I don't know how that would really work in real life, but luckily this isn't real life. It's a comic. So the main character here, for reasons we're not sure of, and she claims to not know, has a Reaper campaign started. These campaigns last for 30 days, and the reward is in the millions. So you can imagine every wannabe assassin, even people who would never dream of killing somebody and just need the money, are after her. And so she turns to another app called Defender to hire a bodyguard. And so that's where the first issue starts out. So it's a very intriguing idea. We learned in the first issue that most of these Reaper campaigns don't get a single bid, don't get a single pledge at all, and most of them go nowhere. So again, the biggest mystery sort of at the heart of this is trying to find out why our main character is, so many people have been willing to pledge to see her killed. And again, she claims not to know. And it seems that to be the case until we get toward the end of the issue. And then maybe she knows a little more than she's letting on to her bodyguard. But it's a really fun issue. I mean, it's an interesting concept. You know, obviously, it's a little far-fetched and it's a little fantastical, but that's fine because it's so much fun. The whole creative team seems to really be in sync here. They seem to be kind of a dream team. They all have similar sensibilities and they work together beautifully, from the dialogue from writer Christopher Sabella to the pencils by Rose Stein, which tend to be a little stylized, a little cartoonish. The inks by Ted Brandt are exceptional, very clean lines, and the colors by Triona Farrell. It's a very bright world, which kind of suits this idea of everything's connected, everything's crowdfunded, everybody knows everybody. It's, you know, it's a small world after all, because everybody's connected through social media. So, and the other thing that, as I mentioned at the beginning, this just felt like a huge amount of story. I think it's 32 pages, maybe 30 pages, if you're not counting like the back matter and stuff. And so you really get a ton of story to kick off this, this title. And it really gives you a good feel for the world and the two main characters, both the bodyguard and the person that she's protecting. So I really recommend this. You know, Christopher Sabella is a name that I try to pay attention to because I tend to like his stories quite a lot. And when I heard this was coming out and I heard the premise, I was like, oh, that sounds really, really good. And, you know, it, for all that story, it's not like the first issue has any slow parts. Like it's really fast paced. Like right away, the main character, Charlie, is in trouble, contacts the bodyguard Vita, and they're thrown right into it with people making assassination attempts while Charlie's trying to fill Vita in on what exactly is going on so Vita can decide if she wants to take the job. So, and it's nonstop action. And it's really, really well done. The story structure, the pacing, the art, everything. It wouldn't surprise me if this is a big, giant runaway hit. It's really that good. So be sure and pick up Crowded number one when you're in your comic shops this week. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is a title that I think I've talked about just about every issue, with the exception of one, on the week that it has come out. And it's just because it's been that good. And it's Gideon Falls from writer Jeff Lemire, with art by Andrea Sorrentino and colors by Dave Stewart. If I didn't mention it previously, this has been optioned to be a TV show. And I can only imagine how creepy it's going to be, because I know some of the creative minds on the television side that are behind it, that are with the production company that picked it up. So I'm expecting really, really great things, because throughout the series, throughout all six issues, this has been one of the most consistent comics that I have read in a really long time. I have said before, in regards to this title, about how amazing it is to me that Andrea Sorrentino, the artist, can kind of scare you and give a feeling of suspense and an ominous tone, kind of a feel that there's something of menace about to happen, even in the middle of the day, even in panels where it's broad daylight. And so we saw last issue, the main character, Father Fred, finally entered the Black Barn. This issue, we finally get some glimpses into the Black Barn. But that doesn't mean it's clear that we know what the Black Barn is, because once he's inside, things get quite weird. And I'm sure a lot of this is symbolism and, maybe some allegory in there. I'm not really sure. It's probably going to be one of those things that makes more sense after we've read more of it, but we are getting little tidbits and little hints, about things that maybe we should know about Father Fred, or things that he would not want us to know. And again, I almost sound like a broken record here, but when you create this interesting world, as Lemire and Sorrentino have done here, it doesn't count for a whole lot. Like, the world can interest you for an issue or so, but if you inhabit that that world with really interesting characters that have little quirks and little foibles, then that's when the world starts to come alive. And Lemire has certainly done that with the Sheriff Clara and her father, Doc Sutton, and obviously with Father Fred, who seems to be somewhat of a damaged individual, but you can't help but be sympathetic toward him for some of the things that he's gone through, just for the fact that he, you know, a lot of people kind of put priests up on a pedestal and think, oh, they're better than us. Lemire's doing a great job of showing that he's just a person who's just as flawed and imperfect as the rest of us, and who is looking for redemption in a way, in a lot of ways. And so we also get a revelation from the bishop in this issue that kind of makes sense, that I kind of saw coming anyway. And then, of course, the storyline with Norton and Dr. Zhu, also really interesting. So this issue 6 wraps up the first volume, and I imagine it's going to read really, really well as a trade, but kind of like the same thing with Analog 5 and with Baby Teeth 12. I really just can't wait for the next volume. This has been a really, really great title. And this one is not flying under the radar. I constantly hear people talking about how amazing Gideon Falls is, and it really is. It's so compelling. It's so spooky and creepy. And it's one of those books where you can read it multiple times and get more and more out of it, because you see little panels or little things within panels that maybe you think of as kind of throwaways, but then you realize later, no, Sorrentino is really doing an incredible job here. I mean, you want to talk about panel layouts on a page? I mean, this artwork is just stunning. It's so detailed. It's so interesting and novel. I mean, multiple times in this title, we've seen where it literally looks like the page is being shattered, and we get a lot of very small panels with pictures, like pieces of that page as it shatters. I mean, I can't even imagine the amount of work that Sorrentino is putting into this book. It's so gorgeous. It's so amazing to look at. It's the best work of his career. I mean, without question, it's simply breathtaking. And I know Jeff Lemire must be just over the moon to be able to have such a talented writer on this book. The only thing that I would wish for differently is, man, I would love like a final collection of this with a director's cut, with like Lemire kind of commenting on, hey, this is kind of what I was thinking in this panel, this is kind of what I was thinking in that panel. Because I can kind of guess toward things or whatever, but I can't, obviously I'm not Jeff Lemire. I don't know exactly what he's thinking. I know it's very impactful the way he's doing it, and some things are pretty obvious, some others are less so. And so I would love to be able to kind of have that director's cut, that commentary from Lemire pointing out, you know, what he was thinking and why this is there and that is there and the details and everything. That would be really amazing. Plus, it would probably give us some insight into what Lemire was specifically asking for in a lot of these panels and what Sorrentino added, which is always something to consider when you have an incredible artist like Sorrentino. So Gideon Falls, really, really good. I imagine the first volume of the trade will be out soon. So if you've been waiting for the trade, I definitely recommend picking it up. Or if you've been reading right along, then you're definitely going to want to pick up issue 6 this week. All right, on to the final book for this week, or the final book I'm going to talk about in detail anyway. It's Skyward Volume 5 from writer Joe Henderson. Art and cover by Lee Garbett. We've got colors by Antonio Fabella and letters by Simon Boland. Book of the week right here, right? This was absolutely amazing. I'm not going to spoil the ending. I wasn't crying. You were crying. A storm comes to the world of Skyward, to the low G world of Skyward. So we see just how dangerous it is when there are storms in low gravity, and that was really cool. seeing the interactions between Willa and her father, who has been a shut-in up to this point and is finally kind of braving the low-G world, that made this issue completely worth it. It was amazing. I love the world that Henderson has created, and you know, just like the other titles that I mentioned, you know, he's got this really cool idea, but the world doesn't completely come to life until he inhabits it with these really interesting and compelling characters. So just like Analog and Gideon Falls and Baby Teeth, this is the final volume of, or the final chapter of the first volume. And I think a lot of things are going to change from here going forward. And I can't wait to see what the future holds for Willa. So again, this issue, it got me. It really did. There's some things that happen where you feel for Willa. It's been, despite the dangers of the low G world that she's grown up in, Willa's very comfortable with that. It's all she ever knows. And she's so used to it that I think sometimes she kind of overlooks the dangers. And with some of the events that happen in this issue, she may be rethinking that. And Fabella especially, Garbett too, but Fabella especially with the colors has been setting kind of a lighter tone that are reflective of Willa's personality, of being a very happy person, of living in this world that her dad is terrified of. And she knows nothing else and loves it. She loves that she can fly and, you know, do all these cool things that you didn't used to be able to do when gravity was at 100%. This issue, we see the colors darken a little bit. And that makes complete sense based on what happens. So I love this book. I can't say enough good things about this book. Go back and listen to the two previous episodes where Joe Henderson was on to talk about it. Because he has some great insight, obviously being the writer and creator, into the world that he has created. And Lee Garbett on art, man, I don't know what to say. It's amazing. There's especially probably my favorite panel in the whole book. There's a scene where Willa's wearing scuba gear and has a gun pointed at somebody, and it's just, you can feel her determination in the panel, and it's palpable, and it's like, yeah, Willa is capable of being a badass, and that's all you need to say. All you need to do is see the panel, and you can totally tell. It's just really, really cool. So I'm loving this title. This particular issue feels like a turning point, feels like a real game changer, and Willa's gonna have to step up after the events of this issue, and that's what I'll say. So oftentimes I struggle between one or two or sometimes even three titles on what's going to be my book of the week. But that wasn't the case this week. There are, every once in a while I'll go through, I'll you know, read my preview copies, and one title just, it's just so apparent. It leaps out at me. It stands head and shoulders above everything else for the week. And that was how I felt about Skyward 5. I mean, Crowded was great. Gideon Falls was great. Analog, Wildstorm, Lost City Explorers. I mean, everything this week was outstanding. But really, once I read this issue, it was kind of a no-brainer on what I was going to choose. So I obviously give this my highest recommendation. Skyward is one of those titles that I think will grow because of word of mouth, and I think it'll do really, really well in the trade. So I love the book, the art by Lee Garbett. I mean, just the fact that this is a world where gravity is 10% of what it used to be, and so he's kind of having to there's no reference, right? There's no reference for people like flying all the time or reference for how the world would change in low G. And so he's kind of getting a chance to make it up on his own, and he's doing an incredible job. It's really, really awesome. I guess maybe he could use a reference of things underwater, because I think that's, you know, kind of simulates lower gravity. At least that's how they train astronauts. But that's not always, you know, realistic based on what he's trying to draw. So anyway, I can't say enough about the art or how amazing this book is. It's really, really great. So I hope you guys all go and check it out. All right, let's talk about some of the other books that are out this week that you might want to pay attention to. Volition number one also gets a huge recommendation from me, also from Aftershock, from writer Ryan Parrott with art by Omar Francia. I think that's how you say it. It's Francia. Had an incredible interview with Ryan. Hope y'all listened to it on this last Aftershock Monday episode this last Monday. It's basically about AI and in the future, robots that basically just want to live like normal lives. So it's pretty interesting, and I found the title to be very compelling, and I'm looking forward to reading more. So really recommend you go and check out that. From Aspen Comics, we have New Way number 2 from J.T. Kroll and Alex Conant. Over at DC, I didn't actually talk about a lot of DC books this time, which is kind of, you know, I know a little weird for you guys. Used to be talking about a lot of DC books, but we've got Batman number 53. We've got Green Lanterns number 53. We've got Harley Quinn number 48, continuing Sam Humphrey's take on that character. We've got Justice League number 6, which we'll be talking about in an upcoming Justice League spotlight. And we've got Teen Titans 23 from Adam Glass. Over at IDW, I wanted to mention that there's a John Byrne X-Men Artifact Edition hardcover. It's pretty pricey, but, you know, if you're a Byrne fan, $125, oversized art, you know, 11.5 by 17, really cool to look at. At Image, I talked about a lot of these books. Analog, Crowded, Gideon Falls. We've also got Ice Cream Man number 6. We've got the fourth trade paperback volume of Kill or Be Killed. We've got Magic Order, number 3 of 6 from Mark Miller. Skyward, as I mentioned, and Wicked and Divine. I know that's a pretty hot title, number 38. From Marvel, Astonishing X-Men, annual number 1. We've got Extermination, number 1 of 5, starting off of that event. Probably be talking about that on the podcast, because I'll be picking those up because they have Mark Brooks covers, and, you know, I'm a sucker for Mark Brooks. Hunt for Wolverine, Claws of the Killer, number 4, which we'll be talking about on our Hunt for Wolverine spotlight. We've got the second issue of Infinity Wars. We've got the first issue of Star Wars Beckett, number 1, starring the character that Woody Harrelson played in the Solo movie. Thor is up to number 4, and the new Tony Stark Iron Man title from Dan Slott is up to number 3. And the last thing I'll mention is from Valiant, we've got Ninjak or Ninja K number 10 from Christos Gage with art by Larry Stroman. And Jesse and I will be talking about that on this Sunday's episode of Valiant Sunday. So, as always, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Please tell your friends about us, subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you listen to us on. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. Next show I should be at is Comic-Con Palm Springs, coming up the last weekend of August, so hope to see you all there. And once again, I want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.